Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, how's it going, man?
All right. That little introductory voice is sure annoying, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, they need to put their stamp on it. It's all because otherwise they'd probably want us to pay for some kind of service from them or something.
Yes, well, I wouldn't mind paying. In fact, we're still using TalkShoe like we did last time.
Yeah.
But I wanted to use this other service that I was looking at called Gabcast. Gabcast just changed over to a you've got to pay for per minute on a per minute basis.
Uh-huh.
And, that was pretty cheap. And but I've got a problem with my debit card, and it wouldn't go through. Just before Mardi Gras, I lost my wallet, and then
I had to cancel
the card. And then I found my wallet, but of course it was too late. And so now I've got a new debit card, but the PIN doesn't work. So it's just one of those things.
Good grief. So sounds like you need a drink.
Yeah, I'm having, in fact, as my nightcap here, a traditional medicinal throat coat tea with lemon echinacea.
Mm-hmm.
A little honey.
So I'm guessing that you have some kind of an illness that you're dealing with.
No, actually, I just, although my around this time of year, maybe it's allergies or something like that, my throat does tend to feel a little, I don't know, constricted or something like that, and I find the that herbal tea, what is it, got slippery elm bark in there?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. It is quite soothing for the throat. But
yeah.
I feel fine. Fit as a fiddle. Never felt better.
Uh-huh. So wait, did I miss the alcohol that was in there?
No, you didn't. There is no alcohol in there because I'm actually indulging in a planned abstinence program.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
Yes, I've given up alcohol for a while, and actually I'm about a third of the way through my regimen. So,
well,
congratulations. 36,
no wonder
yes.
We haven't talked in a while.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm not giving up 40 days for Lent. I'm doing 36 and a half days.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was. You said a third of the way through, and I was wondering if, like, you know, it was 3 nights or 3 hours or what, so.
Minutes, yeah. No, it's 36 and a half days. So, about a third of the way into this exploration of sobriety.
Yeah. Well, perhaps I should join you because I've been wondering, I am continuing to suffer from worsening tinnitus, ringing in my ears, which I think I may have mentioned to you before, and it's gotten really, really bad, and I'm wondering if, you know, one of the options that might have an effect, it seemed to have an effect the last time I took a month off of drinking, so I should probably give it a shot and see if that would help, because...
is there a connection between alcohol and tinnitus?
Well, there's a connection between tinnitus apparently and fluid imbalances in the body or you know, dehydration, that kind of thing. And you know, I tend to live on you know, coffee, segueing into maybe a soda of some sort later in the day, and then into, you know, some kind of cocktail in the evening, and I just don't drink a lot of water at all. I mean, you know, if I can remind myself to drink like 2 glasses of water in a day, I'm doing pretty good for me.
Maybe you should give up caffeine for a while.
Yeah, I should. I am sure I should.
I mean, just for a try. I like to, it's become almost an annual ritual for me. Around May, usually in May of each year, I will kind of decaffeinate myself and go off of coffee. And usually what I'd done for a while was switch over to iced tea for the summer, for the hot months. And, you know, that was pleasant. And then I just decided, what the hell, you know, I'll just go caffeine-free instead over the summer. And then this last year, I'm all thrown off now because having the baby, our daughter was born about a year ago, and then I never went off the coffee last year. Just stayed on all summer long.
Yeah.
I mean, I really am looking forward to the coffee reduction, which I plan to do in a couple months. And then, you got to step it down. A lot of people find that if they just go cold turkey on caffeine, they'll get headaches, and then they'll get right back on the caffeine. So you can avoid that by just stepping it down every day. If you're used to having like, 4 cups of coffee a day like I am,
mm-hmm.
you go down to, from 4 to 3, which is not too hard, from 3
mm-hmm.
to 2, and stay at 2 for a few days, then you go down to 1 for a few days, and then maybe a half cup for a few days, and then you just stop. And it's really actually quite easy. Of course, you have to want to do it.
Yeah. See, therein lies the rub.
Well, I mean, one motivator for me was that I had intermittent insomnia, and it occurred to me that getting off of caffeine could be a good, could be good for that, and so that was, something too positive to focus on, in order to motivate me to actually do it.
Was that did that issue resolve or improve?
I couldn't really say for sure. It wasn't really I thought maybe, like I said, it was an intermittent insomnia, so it wasn't like every night. And so I thought I had maybe a marginal improvement, but not enough to keep me from going back on to coffee in last winter, or the winter before that. And now that we have, of course, a little baby girl, that intermittent insomnia is out the window.
Yeah.
I have learned to collapse in exhaustion.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, nothing like, the intensity of a day full of child to force you to sleep.
Yeah, it's something. Although, if I was a true insomniac, it'd be something entirely different because, the true insomnia, you're exhausted, but you can't sleep.
Ah.
And that sucks.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah, you're falling asleep at work, but you can't sleep. You're lying awake in bed at night, and it's just terrible.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I don't have that.
Yeah. I'm glad for you, really.
But since last time we talked, I've gotten sunburned a couple of times, and it's really sweltering. Well, it's not really sweltering. It was a beautiful day, but it's going to be quite hot in the next couple of days, I think. And I keep looking at the weather map and noticing that you seem to be on the other side of a pretty big divide.
Yeah. Yeah, the mountains and stuff. Yeah, it's pretty cold up here still. We got some snow, a little bit of spitting snow today, nothing too intense. We had a crazy snowstorm come through last Wednesday or Thursday or Friday or something. Sometime late in the week, where it just seemed that, they were saying that there was this winter storm coming in and, everybody was bracing for something to hit. And sure enough, about mid-afternoon, this snow starts falling and it was just practically a whiteout. It was so intensely coming down. And that lasted about 20 minutes and then it was over. And there was essentially no accumulation even, because it was just like this very fast, intense dump that had no time to actually build anything up. And we haven't had snow since then. So it's really kind of an unfortunate winter. I think we're going to be looking toward a potentially very long, dry summer, which is not good.
Oh, yeah. Do you guys get wildfires up there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it really sucks. I mean, it just shuts down your whole life when that's happening. And, I mean, that's just on the purely personal human scale. It, of course, is not particularly good for the forests themselves to have these catastrophic, massive wildfires. Little periodic burns are good for the forest, but you know, when we go 2 or 3 months without rain and there's no snowpack up in the mountains to keep everything moist, it just, it can be really ugly.
Yeah, well, different places in the world, I guess we have different worries.
Yeah, exactly. How was Mardi Gras?
It was great. We had first we had, you know, the girl's birthday, which was the Saturday before Mardi Gras. We had a big party, and that was quite a lot of fun, and my parents were here for their first Mardi Gras ever. And the girl got, she was in great health and great spirits for her party, which was fantastic. But then at her age and being in daycare and all kinds of stuff, she's constantly, you know, coming down with little sicknesses. And so she did, in fact, come down with a cold or something the Monday, the night before Mardi Gras.
Oh, great.
Kind of a big bummer. But, you know, as crazy as the day that we had planned was going to be, there was no way I was taking a sick baby into that, and it was just going to be too much. So, you know, we decided to stay home and just play it cool. But we figured, well, you know what the hell, we can still go ahead and dress up in our costumes, you know, family portrait, because we had, you know, Persephone and me and Christy and my parents, all the kind of matching theme costumes of the different Greek gods that we were representing.
Right.
Gods and titans and so forth. So anyway, we did that, and we dressed up. We took some photos, and then I realized that the Zulu parade, which is one of the premier parades of Mardi Gras, we could hear the brass bands as the parade wound up. The very end of this parade is really not that far from our house.
Oh, okay.
I'd forgotten about that. So we were able to, my parents and I were able to venture over there just to walk over there from our house and see the end of the parade. Not the end of the parade, see where the parade ends. It's a huge parade, you know, and it takes 4 hours or so to wind from where it starts to where it ends. And then the parade itself is probably, I don't know, hours from beginning to end. So we caught the middle part of the parade, which was, I don't know, 10 foot. Something like that. It was really quite something. A few brass bands and other stuff. So anyway, my parents got to see a little flavor of the Mardi Gras madness, and we were in our costumes and we looked really crazy. And people probably thought we were lost, but we weren't. And it was just a good time. So whereas Christy stayed on with Persephone at that time, and we came back and had some food, and you know, so. It wasn't a big outing, but it was fun.
Right on. Well, that's that kind of stuff happens, I suppose, with sick kids and all.
Yeah. We had fun, but it wasn't the fun that we planned. But you know, you can't really plan those things too much.
Yeah. Yeah, we've had a here at the ranch in Montana. We have had a wild one this weekend. Yesterday was one of the most tiring days that I've had with Julian. It just seemed that he was really royally pissed off from the moment he woke up and remained thus for pretty much the whole day. You know, there were some periods of respite, but just screaming and almost kind of spiteful. I think he was sick, and also he's teething, and just tough day. And so I took him. Oh yeah. He'll be teething for quite some time, I imagine. He's going through the really tough ones. He's going through the eye teeth, which are the canines, I think is what we would call them. There's four front teeth that come in, and then a molar that comes in, and then these come in between them. And you know, they just, I had heard that these are tough teeth, and sure enough, you know, he's got a couple of them peeking through it at the same time, and he's just really inconsolable at times, which is, you know, hard to deal with. I mean, I'm sure that you have dealt with it at various times. So.
Yeah, she's got bunches of teeth. I think she's ahead of the curve on the teeth, but she's still not walking.
Uh-huh.
So, you know,
right on.
Different,
well,
everything.
She's what? She's 12, just over 12 months?
Well, yeah, 12 and a half months.
Yeah.
She's very,
and she's
very
been short. Pulling herself up and standing at least, right?
She stands, and she even takes steps. She takes a few steps at a time. And first she took one step, and then she started doing two steps, and then she would, so far I think she's up to three steps at a time, and yet it still doesn't seem like she's really, you know, is she walking yet? It doesn't really seem like walking yet to me somehow.
Yeah.
I've heard so many people, I mean, my dad has told me the story of my first steps and how I, you know, a thousand times at least he's told me this story. And so I always had it in my mind that it would just be a clear-cut thing that one day the baby just starts walking.
Yeah,
crawling one day, walking the next, and boom, just like that. And, of course,
yeah.
Maybe I think for some kids it does happen that way. But apparently also for some kids it's just more of a incremental trial and error, gradual kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I think that it. I know from what I've heard, you know, having gone through, you know, the walking moment with our son, but then also, you know, all the kids that we knew who are his age, because Dylan has a group of moms with kids of very similar ages. I mean, they're all within 3 months of each other, pretty much. That they get together fairly regularly. So, you know, a lot of this stuff happened around the same time. And I guess I don't know how it happened for most of them, but I do know that with Jules, he indeed, you know, like it started one night and all of a sudden he was just walking.
Yeah, that's what PJ said, that he their son had taken a few steps and then they had to evacuate for Katrina. And
mm-hmm.
he had to be strapped into a car seat for the longest time, and that kind of set him back. And then they're up there in Indianapolis, and he just one day just came around the corner walking, and he just was walking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but
wow.
No, I've heard other kids very very much kind of a what do you call it? You know, they mix walking and crawling, and you know,
oh yeah, yeah.
For a long time.
Did you ever see Jules's scoot?
I heard about it.
He never crawled.
I heard, what's that?
He never crawled.
He never crawled.
Crawled. He was
oh,
not
he
a
never
crawler.
Crawled. Yes, yes, yes. No, I gathered it that from when you were describing,
scoot thing. Yeah.
Right, when you were talking about being in China and how they all liked the way that he scooted, I surmised
yeah.
from that he skipped crawling entirely.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he'll do it every once in a while now. Like, it's not beyond him or anything, but he never, I don't think he ever crawled until after he walked.
Yeah, no, I've heard that happens with some kids.
Yeah. So, but, so, you know, according to all the research, of course, he's destined to a life of poor reading skills, I think, is the deal.
Because he didn't crawl?
Yeah. Huh.
Well, you know, life is tough sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. But he's gotten the point now where he is has, like, you know, what could pass for sentences. At least, you know, they feel like they're very clearly sentences to me, but... Huh. You know, I'm fairly tuned into him. You know, so I asked him yesterday what he wanted to do. And he said, I think the order of the words was river, throw rocks. So we finally, I felt like, okay, we've got a mission. I can get him out of this funk by going out, you know, putting him in the car seat, going down to the river. There's a spot that we like to go to because it's a nice sandy beach with a few rocks here and there, and we can go through rocks in the river. And, you know, it's actually kind of on the other side of town. It's not the closest spot. We actually live quite close to the river, but it's a spot a good bit further away. So we got in the car, and, you know, which when it's cold and you have to bundle up, that was about a half an hour endeavor unto itself.
Oh, yeah.
And then drove, you know, 20 minutes over to the spot at the river and got out and walked down to the river. It's kind of a little path, you know, which he gets distracted by the trees and the bushes and stuff like that. So there was another 20 minutes or so. So we were actually, I was starting to feel like, you know, we're actually pushing our time frame because we had to pick up Daylin at a certain time. So we got all the way down to the river. And he was about 10 feet from the edge of the river. He was walking on the sand, and there was this one mud puddle, essentially. And he, as boys tend to do, suddenly veered toward the mud puddle and stepped in it, and it was, I think, softer, wet sand than he anticipated. And he fell down and fell in and completely soaked himself. And so we had to leave. And so there was no rock throwing into the river. So
that's a sad story.
Yeah.
Hey,
so, you
know, rocks,
I was trying to... What's that?
I said, speaking of rocks...
Yeah.
Somebody contacted me today via the Rocks website. And said that they had watched an old Rocks episode. You may remember number 59, J&B Get Baked.
Yeah.
And they said that did we realize that one of the people we interviewed about smoking marijuana, I guess in Dunmeadow, did we realize that one of those guys was Steve-O?
Steve-O?
You know, Steve-O of Jackass fame.
Yeah.
You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wrote back to the person. I said, "Well, I think you must be somebody who kind of looks like Steve-O or something like that."
Huh?
And the guy was adamant. No, but this is Steve-O. He's got the same laugh and everything.
Uh-huh.
And I just find that very hard to believe, but I think it's kind of fun to imagine that he had snuck in there somehow and. It was obviously way before he became famous. And
right.
In fact, maybe we kind of set him off on his path, you know, because he's obviously doing quite well for himself.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, you know, maybe if that is true, maybe we can parlay that into some kind of fame and notoriety, or at least like a paycheck of some sort.
For us, yes.
Yes,
absolutely. He got in trouble for supposedly smuggling marijuana into Sweden, I believe.
Wow. That's a random place to smuggle marijuana to.
Yeah, well, you know, if you've ever been to Sweden, as I have, you would understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I as it happens, I vicariously went there on Friday.
Really?
But, yeah, but only for a few brief still moments. I have there's a photographer at the Missoulian where I work, Linda Thompson, who was born in Sweden, and you know, most people would not in any way mistake her for anything but a true-blooded Indiana girl. Actually, she and I share an Indiana past. But in fact, you know, she kind of has split time in her life between the United States and Sweden. And she recently went back there and shot this series of photographs that was really excellent and very moving about these refugees, basically like teenage refugees from war-torn countries. And you know, I kind of didn't get the full story, but it sounded like all of them were parentless, you know, when they arrived there, and and you know, parents had been killed in wars and stuff like that, and so they ended wound up in Sweden. And there was this great photograph of these two African boys from the Congo sledding on the on these little disc sleds, and they're laughing hysterically. And you know, the thought ran through my mind, you know, could, I mean, among all the possibilities that these kids would imagine for their lives, surely, you know, sledding in Sweden was not one of them.
Probably not, but there's worse things that you could do.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure how to segue from that, but it did occur to me that I thought you said by email something about quizzing me on an old memory.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, and I'm doing this a little bit backwards at this point. So hopefully I have not stuck my foot in my mouth publicly already. But if you were to go to my blog right now, nickelbag.com, you would find a little anecdote told about a memory that I have that's fairly vague, because this was during a time in my life where I was stoned a lot, and stoned a lot with you specifically. And so I'm rather than tell you what I remember, or you know, what at this point I've already told the world happened, I'm curious what you recall happened at the performance of Verdi's Requiem in the Musical Arts Center.
Verdi's Requiem. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I, yes.
First of all, do you even remember being at this performance?
No.
Okay. So maybe I'll jar your memory, because, you know, we went to some operas and this and that together, and you know, we often wore our bathrobes and got stoned and stuff beforehand, so it probably all kind of blended together into some kind of, you know.
Well, but the Requiem is not an opera.
Correct. Yeah. So this was in the, this was a concert that we went to, and we were in the second balcony, or possibly the upper balcony, but I think we were in the second balcony, and the. So this was a concert with, you know, the orchestra on stage and a chorus behind them and four singers out front. And it's a piece of music that is punctuated by some really loud, monstrous, bombastic moments, and as well some points at which, as I recall in that performance, they had trumpet players who were actually spread around the auditorium, like in the stands in the
Wow.
Yeah, so.
That was fantastic.
Yeah.
I wish I'd been there.
Well, I'm quite certain you were. And as a matter of fact, you almost got kicked out.
Well.
Still not remembering this, huh?
No, not quite. Sorry.
Okay. Right. Oh, it's okay. Well, as I recall, I might as well just tell you the story that is now published to the world. As I recall, you and your female companion, who would have been your once future wife, were kind of, you were sitting in the aisle seat, and I think you were in the seat in the row behind me, actually, but maybe you were just to my right, and then you guys ended up in the aisle. And there was a moment at which I noticed a kind of commotion. And so I looked over, and there was an usher ushering you back into your seats. And I guess you all had sort of gotten wrapped up in the passion of the music and had forgotten how public a space you were in, I think, was essentially how it happened.
Wow.
So, yeah. I mean, you know, you weren't naked or anything.
You're in the Requiem?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's music that the biggest criticism of this music by critics and scholars and whatnot is that, you know, this is a very sort of, you know, big liturgical sort of formal ceremony that happens in the Catholic Church, the Requiem.
Yeah.
But Verdi was an opera composer. And so his Requiem, you know, if you didn't know what it was about from somebody telling you, and if you didn't understand Latin, as most of us don't, you would probably think that it was an opera of some sort, or, you know, I mean, I've said to people before that it's a piece of music that will sort of show you the roots of heavy metal music in classical music. Because it's just huge and bombastic and loud and, you know, people whacking on things really loud, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, this reminds me of an idea that I have recently. I've gotten on the Facebook and been connecting up with old high school friends and things like that, and occasionally people will share some kind of memory or story or anecdote, like you just did.
Yeah.
That kind of, you know, something that had completely eluded me and that I didn't remember at all. And I'm sure vice versa. And it got me thinking, wouldn't it be fascinating somehow to create some kind of collaborative memoir?
I think
that would be interesting. But then the more I was kind of interested in that, and I started thinking about how you go about it, and I very quickly got discouraged and decided that there really was no way to do this in any kind of substantive way. I mean, you know, a little sharing here and there, like I just described on Facebook, like you just telling me that and posting it to your blog, those little tidbits, I think that's about as much as I can hope for. I don't think a really grand, systematic, or programmatic, or whatever project is feasible. And here's why: because there's still just a lot of sensitive stuff out there that people couldn't share.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're more of a sharer than most people.
Right. You and I are both very open. But if you wanted to, you know, really get something going where you had multiple people, say, from a high school or who hung out together in college or whatever, you know, a circle of friends from a certain time.
Mm-hmm.
What would make that interesting, of course, is if everybody really is honest and digs deep and, you know, it's more than just one or two people, but it's a whole web of people. And then you start to see whole interlocking stories and so forth. But even with some distance in time, like going back to, say, you know, I was in high school, well, that was over 25 years ago.
Yeah.
There's still stuff that if you were really honest about could get people in trouble and could, you know, could hurt people, you know, could really hurt some feelings and alienate and so forth. And that wouldn't be any fun at all of a sudden.
Oh, sure.
You know, I thought about, you could create, it seemed to me like it'd be pretty easy. You just create a wiki let people sign up and just add their story.
Mm-hmm.
But it actually raises all kinds of questions like, you know, whose voice is anything in, and how do you identify who's speaking about what and so forth. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that this just isn't going to happen. This is never.
Well, but maybe you could do this in a way that sort of keeps the spotlight away from other people's sensitive spots. And
yeah, but those are all the good spots, Jay.
Well, yeah, I know.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, what really makes a story come alive? A lot of time, you know, I mean, sex and drugs and skullduggery and backstabbing and, you know, all that kind of, that's the juicy parts.
And right.
If you can't have that, then screw it. All of a sudden, it's just not that interesting. This has been, I've been thinking about this a lot because I've been kind of, I realized that Katrina and the flooding of our house in 2005 actually kind of acts as a filter on my life. The amount of stuff that I've accumulated and the amount of papers and documents and so forth that I have was drastically reduced. And so when I look at all of the kind of stuff I still have on file, the stuff I've written and so forth, memoirs and journals and whatnot that are still surviving, is all that much more valuable to me now because it's all that's,
yeah, sure,
that's left. You know, for the most part, I've managed to hold on to the really important stuff, but a lot of that extra crap got washed away by the flood. So anyway, I've been sorting through some of that and thinking, you know, noticing that a lot of the stuff that I've written in my life and haven't really done a lot with, but, you know, as I was trying to do things, a lot of it seems generated around trying to tell the story of my life in some kind of way without being too honest, you know, without naming names and being real specific. In other words, without putting it out there in a way that's going to hurt people and so forth, that it needs to be fictionalized to a certain degree in order to do that. And I've attempted to do it this way and that way and so forth. So I've just been looking at that and thinking about that a lot. And that's what got me thinking about, you know, the collaborative memoir idea and realizing that, no, it's not possible. I mean, I would much rather read a fictionalized narrative that's got all the juicy parts in it than a nonfiction narrative that's been, you know, expurgated and censored of anything that's remotely sensitive.
Right. I can see that, certainly. Perhaps limiting the scope of such a project to one event could be at least an interesting exercise. You know,
it could be a party
that everybody remembers, or some kind of an event. I'm not sure what that might be, and you still probably run into such issues, but maybe it should only
if it was a really good party, you would hope so.
Yeah. Well, who knows? Yeah, I think that you're certainly pointing to an issue, though, that sort of thwarts a lot of creativity, at least creativity, reality-based creativity. I don't know if I have the answers.
It's a problem. Well, I want you to think about it and get back to me when you've solved it.
Right on. I will do that.
All right, cool. Well, hey, we've been talking a while here, and of course, we should probably wind it up. I'm thinking.
Right on. Well, let's do it again sooner than later.
Yes, I'm wholeheartedly in favor of that.
Right on.
All right, well, until next time.
Yes, be well.
Bye-bye.
Bye.